Do you see the deals on these brands? Of course you can't. This is a podcast. But when you go to Ross this spring, you'll see brands you know at prices you love. We're talking all the shoes, hues, and oohs at 20 to 60% off department store prices. Go see the savings at Ross.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats.com. And save 15% with promo code DEAL.
Would you lie under oath to help your case?
Yes.
Okay. Have you lied thus far during your testimony at this trial?
No.
But if you had lied, given your last answer, you might not admit it, correct?
Correct.
When Robert Durst took the stand in a Los Angeles County courthouse in August 2021, he looked almost unrecognizable from those who knew of him back in his younger days, or perhaps even more recently in the HBO documentary series, The Jinx. The former New York City real estate heir was now 78 years old, in a wheelchair and connected to a catheter bag. He had been diagnosed with bladder cancer, as well as a number of other ailments. But Robert Durst was finally on trial for the death of his friend, Susan Berman, a case that had first garnered public attention back in 2000, after Susan was found shot to death at her home in Los Angeles. Durst wouldn't be arrested and charged in her death until 15 years later. But that didn't stop the rumors that Durst had murdered Susan in order to keep her quiet about what had really happened to his wife, Kathy, who had mysteriously disappeared in 1982. Durst hadn't yet been charged in his wife, Kathy's disappearance, but the details of her last days would be revealed at his trial for Susan's murder. It was, after all, according to prosecutors, the motive for the murder. Prosecutors also allege that in 2001, Durst killed his neighbor, Morris Black, also in an attempt to cover up what had happened to his wife, Kathy. Now, Durst was charged in Morris Black's death, and a jury recently acquitted him after he claimed that it was an accident that occurred in self-defense. He did, however, plead guilty to evidence tampering, which includes dismembering and disposing of Morris Black's remains. There are so many bizarre details in this case, including other crimes Durst may have committed, and some really interesting tidbits about his past. But it's way too much to cover in its entirety on this podcast. So today on Court Junkie, I'm just going to focus on the more than 3-month-long trial that recently concluded. We won't get into all the testimony, but my hope is that you'll come away having heard the most fascinating parts of a trial that is nothing short of extraordinary. A trial that includes 3 potential murders, pre-recorded testimony from many witnesses who were no longer able to testify, and even arguments about a catheter bag.
I want to make sure that that bag is not utilized as a prop by Mr. Durst in an attempt to incur sympathy for himself, etc.
This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 178. Deputy District Attorney John Lewin gave the opening statements on behalf of the state of California.
You all know who Robert Durst is, and we believe that the evidence in this case is going to show that he is responsible for the disappearance and the death of his missing wife, Kathy McCormick Durst. We're going to show that Robert Durst murdered his close friend and confidant, Susan Berman. And we're going to show that he did that with the motive and because she was a witness. And by witness, meaning that she assisted him in covering up the killing of his wife almost 20 years earlier. Finally, we're going to show that Robert Durst killed, dismembered, and dumped Morris Black's corpse, his body parts, in trash bags into Galveston Bay in September of 2001. So it's going to be three killings that we are going to prove. We're going to prove, even though Mr. Durst is only charged, he's charged with the murder of Susan Berman. He is charged with the special circumstance that that was a witness killing. And in order to prove the witness killing, we need to prove to you what she was a witness to, which means we're going to be putting on evidence that Mr. Durst killed Kathy Durst.
Lewin said all three cases are interrelated, but that everything starts with Kathy. After she disappeared and died at the hands of Robert Durst, he said Robert then killed Susan because he feared she was going to talk. Then he killed Morris Black because he said Morris was putting pressure on him. Lewin told the jury that the motive for Susan's death wasn't robbery or burglary. There was no forced entry into her home. Her windows were locked and unbroken, and her back door was wide open. There were no signs of a struggle, and nothing was taken that day other than Susan's life. Her purse, credit cards, and cash were still on the kitchen counter. He said Susan knew her murderer.
How do we know that? Well, because you're going to hear evidence. You've already heard a little bit of evidence, I believe, that Susan was extremely security conscious. She always locked everything to the point that she was paranoid. Susan had a lot of phobias, had a lot of just personality quirks, and one of them was personal security. So the idea that Susan would have opened her door to a stranger and let them in the house, by the time this case is over, we're going to put on evidence where you're going to come to the conclusion that that is absolutely not what happened.
He said upon entering her home, Susan turned her back to her killer, which he said is a detail that is extremely important. She never knew it was going to happen. She let him in, turned around, took a few steps, and he blew her brains out. She trusted him, he said. The killer wanted Susan's body to be found, and so the killer left a note. The cadaver note, Lewin said. It was mailed to the Beverly Hills Police Department and was found prior to Susan's body being located. The person who sent that note had to have been the killer. On the outside, Beverly in the address was spelled incorrectly. Inside was a note that said 1527 Benedict Canyon, cadaver. That was Susan's address. Lewin said that over the years, Durst said in interviews that he did not find her body and that he did not write the cadaver note. He said this in an interview in 2010 and another in 2012. In 2015, he said Durst reiterated that he did not write the note and did not find Susan's body.
That was his position until a couple of weeks before trial started. He admitted in a stipulation, yes, I wrote the cadaver note.
Lewin told the jury that in fact, in 2012, Durst said this in an interview about the cadaver note, quote, you're writing a note to the police that only the killer could have written. In his 2015 interview, Durst again agreed that whoever wrote the note was the person who killed her. Whoever wrote that note had to be involved in Susan's death, he said. Lewin told the court that Durst believes that the rules do not apply to him. He said Durst is admittedly very tight with his money, which is important because later on, he would give Susan an incredible amount of money. That's stay quiet money, Lewin said. He said Durst didn't want to kill Susan, but that he had to in order to survive.
The problem the evidence is going to show with the murder of Susan Berman is that Mr. Durst committed that murder about 20 years too late. because Susan Berman had already told her story to numerous people.
Lewin then went over the history of Robert Durst and Susan Berman. He said they met in the 1960s while Susan was at UCLA. She was one of Durst's closest and most trusted friends. He said Durst had graduated from Lehigh. He was in California, avoiding the draft and smoking pot by his own admission. When he met Susan, they bonded over their similar backgrounds. Susan had lost both of her parents by the time she was 12. Her father was a mobster and had taken over the Flamingo in Vegas after Bugsy Siegel was killed. Her mom was a showgirl. Susan's dad was eventually found dead, and her mom died by suicide. Durst's mom had also died when he was young and was raised by nannies. Lewin said Susan maintained a strict code of honor with respect to intense loyalty to her friends. He said Susan was also highly manipulative, and that manipulation got her killed. He told the court that she kept Durst's secret for almost 20 years and that he gave her a lot of money to keep quiet. But she was playing with fire, he said. Susan was killed either the evening of December 22, 2000, or the next morning. She had gone out with a man named Richard Markey that night, saw a movie, dropped him off, and came back home. The next morning, her dogs were running around outside loose on a busy street. Her body, meanwhile, was lying on the floor inside her home. She had been shot in the back of the head.
This story goes back to Kathy Durst.
Who was Kathy Durst? In the fall of 1971, when Robert Durst was 29 years old, he met 19-year-old Kathy McCormick, and shortly thereafter, they married. As Prosecutor Lewin said, this story goes back to Kathy Durst. So let's look at what prosecutors presented to the jury about what happened to Kathy. Fatwa Najami was one of the prosecution's witnesses. She testified that her sister, Gilberta, was best friends with Kathy when she disappeared. Now, Gilberta had testified in a pre-trial hearing, but she is now deceased, and so Fatwa was called to the stand to testify. Fatwa said that on the night Kathy went missing, she showed up at Gilberta's house, where Fatwa was too, and was frantic. It was January 31st, 1982.
When she showed up, did she immediately say, "I need to speak to Gilberta"?
I don't remember that exact phrase.
Okay. Did she say something to that effect?
Yeah, I knew that she needed to speak to Gilberta and she was upset.
What was her demeanor that told you all of these things?
Her frantic way that she came in the house and some of the discussion that I kind of overheard in the tone of voices from the kitchen.
Okay, what did you overhear in that tone?
That she was upset with Bobby and that they had an argument.
She said Gilberta was trying to calm Kathy down. At some point, she heard Kathy talking to someone on the phone and saying that she was on her way home and that she loved him.
Given your background, your training, your experience with women who've been victimized by domestic violence, and your experiences in speaking to the thousands of women you indicated, and given the fact that Kathy came in upset about this fight she'd had or argument she'd had with her husband, and her demeanor you described, does it surprise you that Fatwa Najami, who knows what she knows today, does it surprise you that she seemed calm and said, "I'm coming home, I love you"?
No.
Why not?
Because that's what victims of domestic violence have to do in order to survive. It's a survival coping mechanism to keep the peace until they feel it is safe to leave.
Kathy left, and that's the last time anyone saw her. Fatwa said she accompanied Gilberta to the police department after Kathy went missing, but the police seemed to be dismissive of it. Janet Finkshaw was a friend of the Dursts, who said she was very close to Kathy. She said one night in 1981, there was a party, and Robert Durst ended up kicking a man named Peter Schwartz in the head. Peter had reportedly been in a room talking with Kathy that night.
You know, when something like that happens and then you're, you know, totally unexpected and, you know, so, you know, I said, what happened? And people told me, you know, that he was kicked in the eye.
Did the people say who had kicked him in the head?
Bob kicked him.
And was one of those people that was saying that Bob had just kicked the man in the head, was one of them Kathy Durst?
Yes.
And can you describe what was her demeanor, her response at that time?
I think everyone, you know, it's an upsetting moment. So, you know, you're surprised and it's upsetting and you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what do you do now, right?
Janet said Kathy was shocked and that Peter had a broken orbital bone and had to go to the hospital. She testified that she never heard Durst explain what he had done that night, and she had never seen him do that before. A little later, Kathy told her about another incident that had happened with Durst.
Did she talk to you about an incident where she had gone out on the terrace to the neighbors?
Yes.
And what did she tell you about that?
She had told me, it was in the morning.
Let me stop you. She told you in the morning or she said the incident was in the morning?
I don't think the incident was in the morning. I think the incident was the night before I heard it.
Okay.
And she told me that they had a fight and that she tried to escape through the window and he pulled her back in and it was horrifying. And, you know, it sounded like one of the larger fights.
Yeah.
To me, was because I hadn't heard about fights like that, so I was very concerned.
And when she told you this, what was her demeanor as she was telling you the story?
She was crying, she was sad, and she was worried.
Did she tell you during that discussion if she had sustained any injury when this happened?
I believe, to my memory, that I thought she told me that her legs were scraped.
Did she indicate to you during that conversation if Bob Durst had a weapon?
That was the first time I heard that, yes.
What did she tell you?
She just said he had a gun.
Janet said Kathy also told her she suspected Durst was having an affair and that she wanted a divorce. In a separate conversation she had with Durst, he told her he didn't know why Kathy wanted a divorce. There were other witnesses who testified about the potential abuse Kathy had suffered. In pre-recorded testimony, Dr. Peter Halperin said he was an acquaintance and former classmate of Kathy's. He was surprised when she opened up to him and told him that her husband would get violent with her. He said he advised her to leave him. He was later shocked when he saw the headline that she was missing. When he saw on television that Durst was offering a reward for his missing wife, he called the news station to tell them he thought Durst could have had something to do with it. He said they didn't seem interested in what he had to say. In 2003, he reached out to Westchester police to tell them what he knew. He said he didn't originally reach out to them because he assumed Kathy's good friends would have already told them, and he had only had the one conversation with her. He also admitted that he was afraid of Robert Durst. Dr. Leslie Hain was an ER physician who treated Kathy on January 6, 1982, about a month before she disappeared. Kathy had a black eye and bruising on her face. She said she gave her some pain meds but didn't call the police. On Monday, February 1st, Dr. Albert Cooperman, the former associate dean at Albert Einstein School of Medicine, received a call from someone saying they were Kathy Durst. The woman told him she wouldn't be coming in for her first day of rotations, that she was having gastrointestinal problems and a headache. He testified that he knew Kathy, but had never heard her voice on the phone before. two classmates of Kathy's at the school testified that it would be highly unusual for a student to call in sick to the dean during rotations. Then there was Robert Durst's alibi, one he gave the police after Kathy's disappearance. He had said he dropped Kathy off at the train station and then went to their next-door neighbor's house for some drinks. Ruth Mayer testified that she saw Kathy that morning, but did not see Durst that day.
Did Robert Durst ever come over to your house while you were present for drinks that day or that evening on January 31st, 1982?
Absolutely not.
If someone were to say that Mr. Durst came over for drinks that day, the 31st, or that evening, what would you say?
I don't know what you're talking about. Did not.
Are you certain about that?
I am positive.
Ruth's ex-husband, Bill Mayer, said the same, saying he's 100% sure Durst never came over for drinks that night.
You're aware, Mr. Mayer, that Bob Durst told the police back in 1982 that the night his wife disappeared, after he dropped her off at the train, that he came and had drinks with you. Is that correct? You're aware that he said
that? That is correct.
And can you tell me, is that true?
Not true at all.
And are you sure it's not true at all?
Absolutely. I'm absolutely sure.
Elizabeth Jones was a housekeeper at the Durst's cottage. She testified that she found out Kathy was missing when state troopers showed up at the home and showed her the paper, which had the story of Kathy missing on the front page. She said there was what looked like fresh blood on the dishwasher and hidden panels in a closet that had fingerprints on it, like someone had opened them. She didn't know about the panels until she noticed the fingerprints. She testified that a couple of months after Kathy disappeared, Durst gathered all of Kathy's belongings at the cottage and told her to throw them away. Items included Kathy's medical school books, sewing machine, clothes, and various items. Kathy Durst disappeared in 1982, and according to prosecutors, Robert Durst was the one who was responsible. And they also say he had help in the form of Susan Berman, his best friend, who they say helped Durst cover up the disappearance and then kept his secret for years. Until one day in 2000, when Durst then killed her. Investigators had recently reopened the case into Kathy's disappearance, and just days before they were scheduled to interview Susan about it, she was found dead. Robin Carr Morse was a friend of Susan's. She said Susan had told her at one point that one of her good friends had sent her $15,000. That person was a big-name person with a lot of money, but Susan wouldn't tell her who it was. Susan told her that she had harbored a secret for this good friend of hers, a secret that she had kept since the 80s or 90s. Another time, Susan asked her if she had ever heard of a case in New York involving a guy whose wife had gone missing. Susan then told her she was on the inside of some information about the story, but she didn't say what information she had. Robin said Susan was very elusive about the details, but said she knew more about the disappearance than what she was willing to say to authorities. She said Susan clearly wanted her to ask about it, but that she shut her down.
She wasn't willing to talk to me about it. She was very upset, and it was something that she was sitting on. She was very loyal to this person and made it clear that she did not want to expose him.
According to Robin, they had more than one conversation about it.
I remember the night that I last talked to her, that she was very nervous, and she said that someone was coming to see her, that she was going to talk to you about this case, and she said she was going to blow it wide open. It's as if she had information.
She said Susan made it sound like the wife was gone, like she was dead. Robin told the court that in the last months of her life, Susan was living in poverty and had trouble paying for basic things. She said Susan told her that someone was sending her money, but that it wasn't enough, that her friend hadn't come through for her like she thought he would.
These comments about the friend's missing, wife, and the her statements about speaking to somebody about what had happened, did those come up near the time that she was murdered?
Yes.
Do you remember speaking to Susie in sometime in December of 2000?
Yes.
And do you recall during that conversation, do you recall Susan bringing up this issue of the friend's missing wife and the knowledge she had about the case?
Yes.
What do you remember about that?
I remember that she brought it up in the beginning of the conversation, and then, and I was uncomfortable. I didn't want to talk about it simply because it was a hard thing to talk about, and she was getting more nervous. And I sort of tried to distract her, and then she came back to it. And I finally said to her, "Susie, what are you talking about?" And she said, "Robbie, I'd tell you, but your life would be in danger."
Do you remember her telling you that she was going to blow the case wide open?
Yes, yes.
Man, do you recall what Susie told you specifically about what she was going to do?
Yes.
What did she say?
She said, and it was her phrase, that she was going to, that someone was coming and she was going to blow this case wide open.
Robin said Susan was very nervous and anxious about it, but felt strongly that she needed to do it, that she needed to talk to this person who was coming to see her and tell them what she knew. Mella Kaufman was Susan's goddaughter, who was raised by her. One day, Susan talked to her about having provided an alibi call for her friend.
When we were leaving, I believe, we were on Sunset, and she was, you know, it was just another interesting story she was telling me, and she was telling me about her friend and how his wife had disappeared and how she had been an alibi or made a phone call for him so that it wasn't suspicious. And she left it kind of like a cliffhanger. She left me in suspense, like, did he do it? And she kind of smirked and said, "I don't know, you know, what do you think?" kind of thing.
And at the time when she was saying this to you, did she use names of who was involved, or she just referred to this as a friend?
Names.
Okay. Who was she talking about?
Bobby Durst and his wife, Kathleen.
Just prior to Susan's death, Mella said their relationship was very estranged. Susan had cut off contact with her after they had a falling out about a year and a half prior. On cross, Mella said she never mentioned that conversation with Susan when she spoke to producers for the HBO docuseries, The Jinx. She said she didn't feel comfortable and wasn't even sure she wanted to be on camera. Douglas Oliver was a longtime friend of Durst's. And at first, when the prosecutor asked questions about his background, his testimony didn't go as planned.
"Do you recall previously stating, Mr. Oliver, that you married your ex-wife, Rachel, in 1973?
I don't recall me making that statement.
Okay, this is going to be pleasant. When did you marry your wife, Rachel?
In 1973.
And in 1975, did you believe that you had made enough money and you didn't have to work again?
No.
Do you recall saying to me during a recorded interview on October 30th, 2019, that in 1975 you thought you'd made enough money and did not have to work again, and you moved to Paris, but you ran out of money and came back to New York? Do you recall saying that?
No, I do not.
Is that true or false?
Is it what true or false?
Is the statement, Mr. Oliver, I was going to wait a little while, Your Honor, but really, so Your Honor, at this point in time, pursuant to the motion that the people previously filed, Your Honor, I'm going to ask that the witness be designated as an adverse witness.
So, yes, granted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Oliver couldn't recall most of anything Prosecutor Lewin asked him about, and he agreed that he had obtained an attorney and made it difficult for prosecutors to meet with him.
Let me see if this helps. Do you recall, Mr. Oliver, saying to detectives in 2001 that you believed that Kathy Durst might have been sold into white slavery because of her cocaine problem? Do you recall saying that?
I do not recall that. Is that a document you're referring to?
Yeah, it's my document.
May I see that?
No, you may not.
There were also shouting matches between the attorneys. And at one point, David Chesnoff, Durst's attorney, asked for a mistrial. At another point, Oliver asked to speak to his own attorney. During a sidebar, Durst gave him a fist pump of encouragement. Later in his testimony, Oliver said he wasn't aware of any issues in Durst and Kathy's marriage, although he agreed that he had previously told prosecutors that he knew about their problems. When Kathy first disappeared, he said Durst never said anything to him about it.
Don't you find it, Mr. Oliver, completely incomprehensible that your close friend's wife has allegedly disappeared and he never mentions it to you?
I think that's what he wanted, you know? He didn't want to talk about it.
Do you know why he didn't want to talk about it?
No.
Oliver denied having any recollection of watching a movie called All Good Things, which was based on Durst and the disappearance of Kathy. But he said he did recall watching The Jinx.
And you agree that during The Jinx, your friend Bob Durst was very open about the fact that he was physically and emotionally abusing his wife, correct?
Maybe I should watch. I really don't remember anything about the movie. I mean, the Jinx.
A recording of his prior interview was played in court, where Oliver said he didn't want to think about Durst being violent. Oliver testified that he never asked Durst if he killed Kathy or Susan.
Let's talk about Kathy's disappearance for a moment. How did you find out that Kathy disappeared?
I found out through the reading of the papers, the Post.
So you're saying that one of your close friends' wives disappears, and you find out about it by reading it in the newspaper?
Yes.
Did Bob Durst ever talk to you about it?
No.
Did that seem strange to you, Mr. Oliver?
I was a little surprised, but Bobby was always a very private person, and I think when someone disappears, people go through it in different ways, and that's the way he wanted to deal with it, was to be quiet about it, I guess.
He said he recalled asking Durst about Kathy one time. Durst said they were doing everything they could to find her, that it was very upsetting. They were getting sightings from all over the world, Durst told him, and said he didn't want to discuss it. When asked if the Robert Durst he knew would dismember a person, Oliver said he doesn't like to think about that. Throughout the trial, there were periodic stops. When Durst was too ill to continue, attorneys on the defense would ask for a mistrial, or when the prosecution would voice some of their concerns. On June 14th, 2021, Durst showed up to the courthouse in his wheelchair, but was wearing his prison-issued uniform instead of his normal clothes that he had worn on other days. The judge said he understood that although Durst had been deemed well enough to attend trial, he was unable to stand and change his clothes. The defense was requesting a trial delay.
I understand that he is in a good amount of pain because of the catheter.
Not because of the catheter. That's in addition to the catheter. He's in chest pain, and he's unable to breathe completely. He's breathing only shallow when he tries to take a deep breath. It's painful.
The judge suggested perhaps putting a jacket over the back of his chair and a blanket over the front to hide the catheter and the fact that he was in his prison uniform. Durst's attorney said he should be in a hospital and said that until they get him treated, the trial should be postponed. The judge pointed out that Durst had been okayed to come to court.
He told me earlier this morning that he thought it was March. And okay. For the record, we are in June.
We are. So he's been okay to come to court today.
Okay. And, no, he has not been okay. Look at him, Judge. He's not okay.
Perhaps you don't understand what I just said, Mr. DeGaren.
I understand what you said. You said he's okay to come to court. He's not okay to come to court.
No, I said in the past tense, he's been okayed to come to court. In other words, he's been approved by a jail physician to be delivered to court, that he is not too ill to come to court today. So that's, I'm letting the record reflect something that you haven't described. Obviously, he is here. And that is, you make it seem as if it's in a vacuum. I'm sympathetic to his pain and discomfort, and I'm also sympathetic to the extra difficulty that presents for a defense lawyer. I understand that. I used to do it myself. I understand, but this is a very difficult proposition for you.
Prosecutor Lewin then stood up and alleged that Durst has been on tape before, during jailhouse phone recordings, talking about faking illnesses in order to get out of going to trial.
Number one, this doesn't exist in a vacuum. We have to look at what the history is here. The history is Mr. Durst is on tape talking about faking dementia. He's on tape talking about using COVID to get a new jury so he can start over. He's on tape discussing his unhappiness. He filed with the court a letter complaining about the trial, what his lawyers have stipulated to. He doesn't want to be here. He doesn't want this trial to continue. His lawyers have made probably 50 mistrial motions for 60 different reasons. So that's the first issue. The second thing, which I think is important, is counsel's expert and counsel really maligned the hospital jail system, the medical jail system that has been taking care of Mr. Durst. That jail system apparently on Thursday, on their own initiative, got Mr. Durst, saw that he was not in the condition that they wanted him to be, got him assessed, got him treated, got him back here, and it's a urinary tract infection. Certainly not nothing that anybody would want to have, but it certainly is not consistent with the allegations that have been made repeatedly by counsel and by their physician talking about the, you know, abysmal conditions. They make it sound like he's in a prison in China and he is not being given any medical care. That's the next issue. The third issue would be that everybody knows that Mr. Durst has been in jail. There's been evidence that of calls from jail repeatedly in Pennsylvania now, et cetera. The idea that Mr. Durst is in custody on this kind of case is not an issue whatsoever. The court, I would request the court to instruct the jury that simply that Mr. Durst, you know, not to form any opinions, as the court has already said regarding that instruction. And if the jury sees that he is in custody, that really is not an issue.
He also suggested they cover the catheter bag with a blanket. The judge said he wasn't inclined to adjourn, and he provided a blanket for the defense. The trial continued with Susan Harmon, a friend of Susan Berman's, taking the stand. She testified that one day in 1982, Susan called her. She was agitated.
And what could you tell? Don't tell us about words. I want you to talk about tones of voice. What could you tell from tones of voice?
Uncharacteristically confiding in me. Like, just, I got to tell you this.
You just spoke quickly when you said that. Was she speaking quick like that?
Yeah.
She said it was normally the way Susan talked.
I want you to tell us, to the best of your memory, what did Susan tell you on this call?
She said that her friend Bobby had had a fight with his wife. She didn't know what she was going to do. If there was something, she said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I was like, what you're going to do? He'd had a fight. There was an accident on the stairs. And that she had to do something.
Okay. Did she tell you when she said I had to do something, did she say something that you took to mean that she was going to do something to help Bobby?
She had to figure out how to help them, I thought. I didn't know what the him. It was like the situation had happened.
Did she tell you whether Kathy had died?
No.
Did she say anything to you that implied whether it was something good
something
or bad?
Something terrible had happened.
Paul Kaufman was Susan Berman's boyfriend at the time. His video testimony from a 2017 hearing was played in court, and it corroborated what Susan Harmon had said. He said that in 1990, he and Susan were flying from L.A. to New York to meet up with Durst, when Susan said something, almost in passing.
What did Susan tell you about Robert Durst missing wife?
Well, we were talking about scripts in regard to murder scripts and mobster ideas and people that had done things, etc. And in the course of that conversation, she mentioned to me, she said, by the way, you know, Mr. Durst killed his wife.
He said he didn't ask her for any more information, that he wasn't sure if he believed it. Prosecutors also played video testimony of Linda Obst, a Hollywood producer and friend of Susan Berman's. She said that Susan told her that she had done things for Durst that were similar to what her own mom had done for her dad years ago.
The example that she gave was that when Bobby was asked her to or needed her to, she made this phone call to Albert Einstein in Kathy's name.
Just stop when you say in Kathy's name.
Or saying she was Kathy.
She said Susan had called the college for Durst, pretending to be Kathy, the morning after Kathy's disappearance. Linda said she assumed it was common knowledge that Susan had done that, but when she watched The Jinx on HBO, she realized that maybe no one else knew about that after all. Lorraine Newman, a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, testified that she knew about that call too. Her friend, Susan Berman, had told her that she had made a phone call for Durst, pretending to be Kathy. She said she responded negatively to that and that they never spoke of it again. She said she felt tremendous shame that she did not appreciate the gravity of what Susan had told her. Richard Markey was the last person to see Susan Berman alive. They went to dinner and then to a movie on December 22, 2000. According to his testimony, Susan dropped him off at his house around 10:30 p.m. He testified that Susan was very close to Durst, and that she told him she knew things that no one else knew, but didn't elaborate on what they were. Ricky Ring was another friend of Susan's whose videotaped testimony was introduced as evidence. She said Susan was shocked that police in 1982 accepted the supposition that Kathy had run off with a drug dealer. She said Susan was also surprised that Durst threw out Kathy's possessions days after she disappeared, and then never mentioned Kathy when he and Susan went on a vacation a few months later. She said Susan was incredibly loyal, just like her mobster father. She said Susan's dad was once imprisoned at Sing Sing, but never ratted out any of his colleagues. Susan would never rat anyone out either, she said. After Susan's death, Ricky said she made an anonymous phone call to police and said, Susan was not killed because of anything to do with the mob. Bob Durst killed her. Brad Roberts was the lead detective in Susan's murder. He recalled the details of when he first responded to the scene and how there were no signs of forced entry or signs of a struggle. He said Susan's purse was there, everything intact. Monday, June 28, 2021, started with a hearing outside the presence of the jury. Prosecutor Lewin said he was concerned that Durst was trying to gain sympathy from the jury by periodically holding up his catheter bag and showing off the scar on his head. Then Durst stood up and spoke to the court.
Mr. Lewin is incorrect. I am not seeking sympathy from the jury. My head is shaved. This is the only kind of haircut I'm able to get in the jail. In terms of the, we talked about my, in Galveston, the DA said I lowered my chair. I would look little. Everybody thought that was ridiculous. I put the chair at a height that was convenient for me. In terms of this whole thing about my seeking sympathy and trying to harm myself with my catheter bag, I have been doing everything possible to get the juror, to get the doctors at CTC to remove the bag. I don't want to have the catheter at all. This issue about emptying the bag is something Mr. Lewin is raising. I don't think it's meaningful. I would request the court, if the court can do so, to encourage the doctors at CTC to remove the catheter, since nobody is willing to tell me why I have a catheter in. Thank you, Your Honor.
A little later, Durst could be heard talking loudly to his attorney, David Chesnoff, saying, "No, it will inhibit me from making him look like a fool when he cross-examines me." The state introduced video testimony from Julie Smith, who is a friend of Susan Berman's. According to her testimony, she had a conversation with one of Durst's good friends, Nick Chavin, after Susan had been killed. She said Chavin asked her if Susan had ever told her that Durst had killed his wife, Kathy. Julie said no. Chavin then told her that Susan had told him that, and that it was something they overlooked because they loved him. Pre-recorded testimony from Nick Chavin was also played for the jury. In it, he testified that one night after dinner, Durst told him this about Susan. "It was her or me. I had no choice." Douglas Durst is Robert Durst's younger brother. He testified that he and Robert, one of his three brothers, never really got along, but that it's still difficult to be testifying against his brother. He testified about their family's history and also about what he knew about Robert and Kathy's marriage during the time period of January 1982.
Kathy had told me that she was seeking a divorce from Bob.
And do you recall specifically when she told you that?
It was in the winter of 1980. I don't remember if it was at the Christmas party or not.
He said the first week of February 1982, he got a call from his brother. This was days after Kathy disappeared.
And do you recall when he called you, what was his demeanor?
His tone, it was very neutral, and there was no great anxiety in his tone.
Did that seem unusual to you at the time?
It seemed a little strange, yes.
He said Durst implied drugs were involved in Kathy's disappearance and said a drug dealer had been over at the apartment. Durst then told him he had put Kathy on a train and then hadn't heard from her since. On Tuesday, February 2nd, the day after Kathy's disappearance, he said his brother was not at their real estate office. They were supposed to have a closing that day, but it had to be postponed.
I want to ask you, are you aware that your brother has previously said that on Tuesday, February 2nd, 1982, he was in Connecticut, quote, scouting, unquote, for property to buy for the Durst organization? Have you ever heard that before?
I have heard it, yes.
And can you tell me, would such scouting for property, would that have been a part of your brother's portfolio or job responsibilities?
No, it would not have been.
And can you explain, did your family, did the Durst organization, did they scout for property in Connecticut at that time?
No, we were actively building a building, and we were not looking to acquire additional property.
Douglas was asked how his brother feels about him today.
What are those feelings?
He'd like to murder me.
And are you aware of your brother, in fact, making calls from Pennsylvania discussing that very subject?
I am aware of that, yes.
Did you take those, and this is a yes or no question, do you take those threats seriously?
Yes, I did.
And even in terms of your coming to court today, did you come with security that you had hired?
Yes, I hired security today.
And why did you hire security? What was the reason for that?
Because I have fear that my brother has threatened to kill me, and I have fear that he may have the means to do so.
Next week, in part two, we'll get into what happened to Morris Black, Robert Durst's reaction after HBO's The Jinx aired. We'll hear from a very close friend of Durst's, whose testimony is interesting, to say the least. And we'll finally hear from Robert Durst himself as he takes the stand.
As you sit here right now, I'm going to ask you, did you kill Susan Berman?
No.
But if you had, you would lie about it, correct?
Correct.
I'll also go over the conclusion of the trial and some updates that have occurred since the trial concluded. In the meantime, you can chat about this case on Instagram at Court Junkie, on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, or you can always email me your thoughts at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A special thank you to Kathy Rusan from Law and Crime. She covered this trial every single day and took the most diligent notes, which she let me take a peek at. If you like following trials, make sure you're following her on Twitter at Kathy Rusan. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.